And we'll call the next case, U.S. versus Temple. Have a safe flight, Mr. Frank.
Bag it of snow that much, please, God, but go ahead. They may follow you to Washington anyway. We've enjoyed having you here.
Mr. Lowe?
Thank you.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Jordan Loeb. I represent Christopher Temple. There are three issues that I'd like to bring to this court's attention regarding the sentencing of Christopher Temple. One was certain associations that were included in the pre-sentence report to which Mr. Temple objected. The second issue is terms of supervised release that Mr. Temple believes are overly broad, and finally, the sentencing structure as a whole in light of recent decisions by the United States Supreme Court, including Booker. The associations that Mr. Temple objected to were references to the United Citizens for Justice, which later became the Militia of Montana and the Aryan Nations. These are names that have kind of a toxic ring to them. Even without further insight, Mr. Temple has consistently denied associations with these groups, and these associations have persistently pervaded this case. Mr. Temple argued at sentencing that there was no proof of association, yet it was included in the PSI, and the addendum to the PSI goes on to cite the proof being a single article from the Southern Poverty and Law Center referring to the Sage of Spooner. It's in their 2003 intelligence report. The only other reference to the truth of this information is a line in the pre-sentence report addendum saying that there is other information on the internet. Without being too critical of the internet, it alone is not an accurate source of information. One must look behind that information to determine the truth of it. The problem with this information is it follows Mr. Temple. It follows him everywhere he appears. And despite people saying, I'm not taking that information into consideration, it's the type of information that is almost impossible to ignore. Association with right-wing hate groups, anti-government groups, groups that have, at least in hyperbole terms, declared war on the government of the United States. It's almost impossible to conceive that this information was simply ignored. And the record seems to suggest it wasn't ignored. When the government responded to this point at sentencing, it argued this is a fact that the court should know in a pre-sentence report so they know who they're dealing with. Later, though, the disclaimer, I don't really think it has any sort of effect on sentencing. It's hard to fill in the gap between those two conflicting comments. Even the court engaged in the same kind of dichotomy. The court held that these are the sort of associations the Bureau of Prison needs to know about, suggesting that the court believed these associations were in fact accurate.
And I want you to get back to those points, but I want to get on to the Booker guidelines issue, because here we have a judge who assumed that the guidelines were advisory, that the Supreme Court would rule in that way, and that the guidelines were only suggestive. And so I want to know how you know why this case should be resentenced in light of the fact that the court applied the guidelines as advisory and not binding.
Thank you. This point dovetails nicely with that. In a sense, the court anticipated that she should impose an indeterminate sentence, but did not make a very clear record of exactly what factors about Christopher Temple or his crime she was taking into consideration. So once again, his concern that he was being viewed as a Nazi, even though the court made a great effort to say, I'm not considering it, might have impacted his sentence, because the record isn't real clear. Judge Crabb did impose...
What else could she have said other than the fact that I'm not taking it into consideration at all?
Could determine that it wasn't accurate, as Mr. Temple asked.
Yeah, but if it doesn't make any difference. Its accuracy has nothing at all to do with the issue at hand, and that is that she didn't rely on the mandatory provisions of the Act. She assumed it was advisory,
if we look
which
at,
it is. now, apparently, at least pro tem.
Standing on shifting sands, I suppose you have to be able to change your balance quickly. The factors in 18 U.S.C. 3553 list things that the judge should articulate at sentencing as things to be considered. Since we don't have a very clear record on what the court in fact considered, we're left to wonder how this was ignored or if this was ignored. What we have is...
What I want to know is how you could say it more clearly than to say, don't take this into consideration at all.
And I recognize you were probably too young to remember what it was like pre-guidelines, but courts did that routinely, said that the government would put forth some facts or some factual allegation. The court would say specifically, not considering this, and that was good enough. Why isn't that good enough now?
The argument Mr. Temple made at the outset was this should not be in the pre-sentence report. It's not true. He wants it out of the report, even if it didn't affect the actual sentence, the amount of months he's serving in the prison. He doesn't want this label following him. And the real question is, what is the mechanism to remove untruthful information from a government record, from the Bureau of Prisons record?
He does probably not, unless it has an effect on the prisoner himself.
How could this not, is the question. He's being labeled with one of the most distasteful labels.
Well, all you got to do is quote to them what the judge said. He didn't care about the damn thing. That takes care of that.
And then if there's some problem in terms of his housing or classification because of that identification, then you come back to the trial court on a motion. I mean, I recognize that you have to deal with, you know, how long the court has jurisdiction over the case. But once... of what under the guidelines, and of course now the guidelines, I don't think they affect timing, but what is the time, like 120 days to come in and correct a sentence, or I'm just not clear the time. But anyway, there's a way I think you can get to that, but I agree with Judge Bauer, you just show the Bureau of Prisons the court order. She didn't take that into account.
Where can they? No way to stop rumors from floating around.
Well, one way is to take them out of print and official documents, and that was the point. And I understand what the court's saying.
But the official document we're worried about is the decision and sentence of the court, not what the probation officer threw in. Maybe the probation officer threw in that they produced three illegitimate children, too, but nobody cares about that either. So they're not making a legal finding, the probation officers. I understand your concern, and you're doing a splendid job of calling our attention to it. So,
I understand what the court said, and I'll move on to my other points quickly. The other thing that Mr. Temple objected to is this very broad condition of supervised release that he notify the public of his conviction. Certainly, I understand the court's reasoning when he's drafting articles that have to do with investment or recruiting people to put faith or money into him, but the provision that he publicly notify the public of his conviction is overly broad. I think
and
I will.
And do you want to save the rest of your time for rebuttal?
I will save
All
the
right.
rest of my thank you.
Thank you. And is that Mr. Vaudreau? Will you pronounce your name for me?
Vaudrey.
Okay.
I think it's actually Vaudreuil, but...
Actually, he's been here so often, we ought to be on a first-name basis.
Yeah, but it's so rare that I get to preside. I never get to pronounce the names.
And I am old enough to remember the pre-guidelines. There's no doubt about that. For the record, I guess, I'm John Vaudreuil. I'm an assistant up in Madison, and I represent the United States below and represent today. I will briefly address the Rule 32 issue, and then I want to turn more really to the more interesting issue, I guess, at least, the just the sentence itself and the process. I think... what Mr. Loeb is really saying is that, in so many words, when he says the record isn't clear and whatnot, I'd have to agree with the court. There's nothing else Judge Crabb could have said. Rule 32 gives the court two options. You can either resolve the factual dispute or you can choose to ignore it at sentencing. Judge Crabb took that option. She said she's not considering it at sentencing. It's not lip service. She wasn't fibbing. Judges have said this. These sorts of things forever and will continue to say so. So the fact that she said, well, it's interesting, BOP might want to consider it, has nothing to do with the sentence imposed in this case. As it actually relates to BOP and the document that this court is not really concerned with, but Mr. Loeb, I think justifiably, and Mr. Temple is, the PSR, that obviously does follow Mr. Temple to the to the Bureau of Prisons. They look through it to classify him and so on. But at that point, if the information is such that it puts him in a different institution or a segregated housing, lockdown housing, that sort of thing, there is the administrative process. You can challenge those facts administratively. I never actually played one of these out, but I suspect if the BOP disagreed, you then certainly have, in the district of your confinement, a habeas challenge to your conditions of confinement if you were locked down or something like that. I would like to think that rather than putting him in danger, since no inmates are given access to other people's PSR, that it might act to protect him. If somebody errs on the side of caution and does not put him in a position where if he does have these beliefs, he is not in danger, it probably inures to his benefit. But I think the bottom line, the legal issue is that she chose one of the options, door number two, if you will, under Rule 32, and chose to ignore the facts. As it relates to the sentence itself, the one thing that hasn't really been addressed, I don't think, yet today, and I think is really the ultimate question, is there is no Booker error. This was the first sentencing post Blakely, I believe, with Judge Crabb, and as the court's seen from the briefs, we took, or I guess I took, the trouble to write sort of a long letter setting out our position, and then another long letter just before sentencing saying here are the three alternatives. She chose the one that I believe was correct and turned out to be correct. She did impose an indeterminate sentence. She used the guidelines as advisory and said she was considering the 3553 factors. Obviously just what she should have done. I think the ultimate question today, though, then becomes after Booker, is the sentence reasonable? And that's what the Supreme Court tells us. I'm not so sure we have, I guess I am sure, we don't have lots of guidance yet on what reasonable means. Does that mean that it was not an abuse of discretion? I'm not sure about that. What I am quite sure of and confident here is that this was a reasonable sentence. The government didn't appeal it. I'm not contending that since she went from 87 to 72, as I recall, that she went below the guideline range, that that's unreasonable. That day might come, but not this case, certainly. She said she was using him as advisory, and I think what the real argument becomes, as I hear the argument today and as I read the supplemental brief that Mr. Loeb filed, is that she sort of gave a kind of cursory review of the 3553 factors. Again, she said, I'm considering the 3553 factors. She said, perhaps briefly, but she said this is a serious crime. It was over a long time, had a severe impact on upwards of 60 victims or so. And she said this sentence will reflect the seriousness of that. It will protect the public. But she also went on to say that it's not so long that you're not going to have a chance to get out at some reasonably soon time to begin restitution. So I don't think that the test, however this court decides to frame it for reasonableness, should be, well, a district court judge has to actually list each factor and has to give a small dissertation on each factor under 3553, because that, I think, in my opinion at least, demeans the role of the sentencing judge. Judge Crabb said she was considering it. She then discussed generally those things. There was a lengthy PSR. We'd had an argument at sentencing, so all the facts were there. So I think the ultimate question is this a reasonable sentence, using the guidelines as advisory and using the 3553 purposes? And I think the answer is quite clearly yes. Just briefly, as it relates to the supervised release condition, I won't say much more than I put in my brief. The real question becomes, in this abuse of discretion review, was the crime, as it was committed, is it matched up sufficiently closely, I guess, with this condition of supervised release? And Mr. Temple was on the radio. He was on. He had all these, the National Investor, the Spotlight, these various publications, where he talked about investing and so on and so forth, for reasons that I suppose I never understand. People thought, hey, this is the way to put all my money. And then they gave him lots of money, $1.6 million or thereabouts. And what Judge Crabb decided was important was, since that was the mechanism by which he, and perhaps not directly addressing you to get your money, but just generally giving his sort of the patina of brilliance, if you will, in the investment world, was through these mechanisms, she would require that in those public, the articles he writes, the publications he owns or edits, those sorts of things, or when he's on public broadcasts where he's participating, that he'd have to say this disclaimer. It isn't just standing on the Capitol steps in Madison on a daily basis proclaiming that you are this convicted, but if you intend to write an article, if you intend to speak on the public airwaves, you will have to give this disclaimer for the time of your supervised release, and I would submit that is not an abuse of discretion. That matches up hand in glove, really, with the with the nature of his crime and how he did it. So if there aren't any questions, I'll sit down.
All right. Thank you. I guess my question for you, Mr. Loeb, is what other arguments could have been made to the court that were not encompassed in the factors of 3553? You know, because your argument is basically the court didn't take into account fully the purposes of the guidelines, and Booker gave you freedom to argue issues that might fall outside the guidelines. What issues would you have argued or presented that were not included in the 3553 factors? Because when you look at those factors, the history and characteristics of the defendant, which, you know, under the guideline regime, was very limited the impact that those factors had. I mean, what would you have argued differently?
What?
Or what were you unable to argue in light of the fact that the court sentenced under this regime as a discretionary?
And to be fair to the court, I don't feel that my ability to argue points was limited. It was the argument that I'm making today essentially is the record isn't clear on whether those arguments had any impact on sentencing, and I think they should have. One was that Mr. Temple was actively making restitution from the time the government interrupted this scheme. He began making restitution payments. The second thing was that he has a severely disabled child for whom two parents giving care is not nearly enough, and that was a factor the court could have and should have considered, that there were needs for him at home. And
that was pointed out to the court, right? And that was in the PSI, and that was argued?
It was argued.
At the sentencing?
At sentencing. And these are the types of things that I'm not arguing that the court should make a small dissertation. I'm arguing that the court should make factual references to the factors in 3553, not just stating that there is a statute and that the court is following it, but actually tying the facts to that statute. The reference is made that I'm too young to remember pre-guideline sentencing. That's true. I was not practicing at the time, but in state court, that's exactly the procedure. The court not only has to note the factors, but then talk about how these factors are being considered in light of the facts, and that's what we're asking for today. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the case under advisement. Thanks to both.